Yeah, how are you doing? You well? It is Thursday today, the 7th of March, 2024. My name is Richie Allen. This program is coming to you live from Salford City. It's always a pleasure to be in your company. So it is. All right then. Shut up, Baldy, and get on with it. I hear. Ah, yeah, okay, I'll get on with it then. Two very good guests today.
Uncensored, unfiltered. You're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to you meeting Sophie Ottaway in the second hour. What an amazing story. About 15 years ago, Sophie found out by accident when she visited her GP that she wasn't a girl, a young woman, that in fact she'd originally been born a boy. She went public with this late last year. We'll talk with Sophie about her decision to go public with it, why she did it. Fascinating woman. I can't wait for you to meet her. We'll do that in the second hour. Before that, the investor, the academic Melissa Shumay, returns to the Richie Allen Show. We'll talk about a number of things with Melissa. We look ahead to the referendums in Ireland tomorrow, but we'll also take a look at the financial picture. We'll look at extremism. We'll look at lots with Melissa Shumay. She's always great value. So there you are. That's today's programme. Hope all has been a decent day for yourself. I hope you've been in good form today. I won't get into it too much, but the climate stuff has been everywhere today. Yeah, they've been telling us that climate records continue to fall in the world's warmest February. Now, this isn't true. It isn't the world's warmest February of all time, as they talk about since records began. But thousands of years ago, you wouldn't have been able to live in the Northern Hemisphere. It was so warm and there was less CO2 in the atmosphere than now. I'm not getting into any of that. But each month since June 2023, they tell us as the new temperature highs for that time of the year. It won't be long before we need some of these, remember?
I do feel that every week on the television there should be the Prime Minister flanked by two climate scientists explaining what has been done to mitigate climate change. And that's not happening.
Yeah, we need a climate briefings like COVID briefings. That always stuck in my mind, that they're kind of doing it already. They're telling us already, aren't they? Every 10 minutes that we're going to die in climate catastrophe. Before I tell you, let's look at a couple of stories in the press today. Oxford planners drop toxic 15-minute city phrase, according to the Times. Did you come across this today? I missed this morning when I read the Times, but it's in the Times. Oxford City Council has dropped references to 15-minute cities from key planning documents, but has vowed to keep promoting cycling, walking and bus use. They said the urban planning concept, 15-minute cities, coined to encapsulate livable cities where people can walk to schools, shops and GPs 15 minutes from home, had become, quote, too toxic and incendiary as a result of opposition stirred by conspiracy theorists. It's your fault. It's your fault for daring to challenge it. You conspiracy theorist madman, you. Or mad woman. So they're dropping it. Can't have it. It's causing too much division. So Oxford was at the centre of a row last year, you remember, about traffic reduction plans, when an Oxford County councillor said plans for new, quote, traffic filters in the city designed to reduce car use would support the 15-minute city idea. Yeah, so the Times goes on to quote a number of so-called conspiracy theorists, which I won't mention. I won't mention their names. It's a real shame that, because there are pretty well-known scientists who say it's all a load of nonsense. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. They're going to drop the term 15-minute cities, but they will continue to pursue greener forms of transport to ease congested streets and all of that. Yeah. Of course, we know what they really want to do. 15-minute cities are a real thing. They do ultimately want to confine people. I did hear a little bit of chatter about this on the radio today, and they were saying, this is a ridiculous conspiracy theory. You know, they're talking about climate lockdowns. This is nonsense. There won't be any climate lockdowns, according to various commentators today. By the way, your BBG coined the term climate lockdown. It was me. I came up with the idea 4 years ago. And that's ultimately what it's going to be about. As the climate fear-mongering becomes even more hysterical in the coming years, they will be coming up with new and exotic ways of encouraging people not to really travel too far from your home to reduce your carbon footprint. Anyway, number of things in yesterday's budget that have nothing to do with the cost of living crisis. One of them was about drones. Which did, again, there was a bit of chatter about this today. Did you come across this? Police will deploy drones as first responders in emergencies under a £230 million budget cash injection to boost the use of advanced technology. I'm reading from The Guardian. Amazing. So we watched all of these wonderful sci-fi movies in the 1980s as technology, special effects became even more impressive through the 80s. And a lot of science fiction movies imagined a fairly dystopian future where people were controlled and where drones flew about the place monitoring people. Yeah, so one of the things he wants to do, Jeremy Hunt, is help save the police time and money by using technology. And they could send drones out by way of first response to determine whether or not it is necessary to then send out police cars, presumably. But drones flying around. I mentioned this on the show some months ago and they seem to have disappeared. A few months ago, I noticed that three or four drones were constantly hovering above Salford City back in... what are we talking about? From late summer last year to Christmas. And I put in a, not so much a freedom of information request, but I asked Greater Manchester Police what was going on. And I got no response from them. But I later found out they were running, operating drones, and the drones were basically up there spying on the, not spying, yeah, you could say spy, but obviously spying. What's wrong with me? Basically monitoring traffic. But that was bullshit. Because I leave my house usually around about five. I leave here with my dogs about 4:40 a.m. every morning. Not every morning, most mornings. And these things were visible at 4:40 a.m. There's no way they're monitoring traffic at 4:40 a.m. They're getting us used to the idea that the drones will be flying around monitoring us. In fact, Amazon and pretty much anybody who delivers anything, they want to introduce drones as a means of delivering things in the near future. Spooky stuff, very little pushback against it. India Willoughby, have you heard of India Willoughby? India Willoughby is a woman, allegedly, with a bigger penis than me. And women can have penises, of course, according to the leader of the Lib Dems.
So women can have a penis?
Well, quite clearly. Well, quite clearly.
Absolutely.
Well, quite clearly.
Women can have penises. Davey. So India Willoughby has called, the old Bill has phoned the police to report that he, because India Willoughby is a man, was misgendered by J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling might have too high a profile for the old Bill, I don't imagine. The police will be knocking on JK's door anytime soon, but you never know. Just gone 8 minutes past the hour. So speaking of the budget then, as we did a moment ago, there was a very interesting budget announcement yesterday, which I tweeted about, but I didn't get into because I thought we'd have more time to get into it today.
Now, there weren't many specific business measures.
By the way, this is Ian King, Sky News.
Now, there weren't many specific business measures in yesterday's budget, but one eye-catching announcement was that AstraZeneca is to invest a further £650 million in the UK. The FTSE 100's biggest company will invest £450 million to research, develop and manufacture vaccines in Speke on Merseyside. A further £200 million will go on expanding AZ's presence in Cambridge, where 1,000 people will work alongside its existing £1.1 billion Global Research and Development Discovery Centre, which already hosts 2,300 researchers and scientists.
Yeah, but wasn't AstraZeneca's COVID jab a total disaster? We'll come back to that. He went on to speak to the UK president of AstraZeneca, a man whose name is Tom Keith Roach. Tom Keith Roach, honestly. Yeah, yeah, insert whatever you want between Tom and Roach. Cockroach, maybe. Here he is, Tom Keith Roach.
It's a very positive day for manufacturing and for life sciences in the UK.
Well, it's not a very positive day for the health of the nation, though, is it? If you're giving money to a company that's caused incredibly serious damages and injuries to people through their own COVID jab, we'll come back to it.
We already have a vaccine manufacturing facility here in Speke, where I am now. And actually, this Northwestern corridor is the home of vaccines, research, development and manufacturing in the UK. So it was a logical place for us to partner with the UK government to build a new strategic hub to develop the medicines of the future to protect the UK against future pandemics.
Now, this time last year, your CEO, Sir Pascal Soriot, was citing a new factory in Ireland. And he...
No, Ian King. No, that wasn't your follow-up question. Your follow-up question should have been, thanks for that, Tom. Can I ask you for a comment on the fact that 10 days ago, a group of MPs, importantly, claimed that the medical regulator, the MHRA in this country, failed to sound the alarm over your COVID vaccine and the side effects that it was causing back then? Could I have your response to that, Tom? Keith Roach. But he didn't. Didn't ask him. The old Parliamentary Group on Pandemic Response and Recovery, which is a very influential group of MPs apparently, raised serious patient safety concerns. The MHRA knew that the AstraZeneca jab was causing widespread harm, clotting, heart issues, stroke and all of that in February 2021, but didn't highlight the problem for months. Tom, what's the government doing getting into bed with you to the tune of 650 million quid to build vaccine manufacturing hubs? You're not really in any position to be getting any contracts from the government now, are you really, Tom? Is what he should have said, Ian King, but don't blame him. He's as useless as a condom is to a eunuch. Useless. And that's your follow-up question. What are you doing? Why are you still in the country, Tom? Shouldn't you be running to Mexico or something along those lines? Mad stuff. We'll leave that one alone for the moment. Michelle Donnellan, I believe, is the Science and Technology Secretary these days. She had education for a bit. They move around so much. You might have heard on this programme, she libelled a university lecturer. She declared on Twitter that a university lecturer was a supporter of Hamas, which was nonsense. She was ordered to pay £15,000 in damages to the lecturer. Remember, this is a government secretary of state. Now, the taxpayer will foot this bill, which is annoying a lot of people today. Here's Sky News. Again, Sky News with the story.
Well, staying with politics, the Prime Minister has also addressed criticism surrounding his science secretary, Michelle Donnellan. Ms. Donnellan falsely accused a scientist of being a terrorist sympathiser, paying £15,000 of taxpayer money in damages. Labour are demanding she pay it back. Speaking earlier, Sir Keir Starmer described it as insulting.
I think most people watching this would be aghast. The government is telling them every day that they can't do any more to help them. People are really struggling to pay their bills and the government says we can't afford to help you anymore. People know their public services are crumbling. And then you've got a minister who says something she shouldn't have said, then has to pick up a legal action and pay damages and costs, and then says the taxpayer's going to pay for that. Totally insulting.
Insulting, says Keir Starmer. What about the Prime Minister of the country, Rishi Sunak, Donnellan's mate? What say he?
My understanding of this is that Michelle had raised some concerns about some articles that had been shared.
No, she didn't raise some concerns, you jug-eared moron. She declared the university lecturer to be a supporter of Hamas. She didn't share her concerns. She accused a woman in the private sector of being a supporter of a prescribed group, as Hamas is. Let's be honest about it.
About talking about what happened on October the 7th, I think subsequent to that, those thoughts and everything have been clarified and Michelle has withdrawn those concerns. With regard to the settlement, it is a long-standing convention stretching back many years over different governments of all different parties, including Labour, that the government will fund those legal disputes when it relates to government ministers doing their work.
But she wasn't doing her work. She went after a private citizen on Twitter and accused her of supporting Hamas. It's outrageous. That is a law or a tradition that should be sent to the scrap heap, shouldn't it, dear listener? They should libel people on their own dime and not on ours. Scandalous, that. A lot of people pissed off about that today. You want to go and libel somebody, accuse them of something they're not, or say they did something they didn't, you pay for it yourself, I would say to Michelle Donnellan. The Irish referendum tomorrow, referendums tomorrow. We'll get into this with Melissa. You know about the Irish referendums, you do. There are two proposed amendments to the Irish Constitution. These are the Family Amendment and the Care Amendment. The first one, the first vote, the Family Amendment, will be asking people to expand the definition of a family to include those in durable relationships. Okay? So that's what they'll be asking people to say aye to say yes to expanding the definition of a family to include those in durable relationships. Let's get the thoughts of Irish Independent Senator Michael McDowell. Michael McDowell, here he is speaking again. Strangely enough, it's all Sky today to Sky News on that.
Well, Jane, the Irish Constitution has a special article dealing with children's rights, and the courts have consistently upheld the rights of children in single parent relationships and their mothers on an exactly equal basis with married mothers or widowed mothers. There is no discrimination. But what they're proposing to do in relation to that is to say that other durable relations, which they won't define and they wouldn't allow the Parliament to define, will in future be equated to families without considering what the complications that will arise from that are. And I'll just give you a simple example. If an unmarried mother and...
Now listen to this very carefully. This is actually complicated. He's explaining it as well as he can, but he's giving a hypothetical situation, right? If, in fact, the Irish people do agree to change the Constitution. Listen to this. So if an unmarried mother, right?
And her child is deemed to be a family, and she teams up with a man and has another child, is that a second family or is that her first family? And if he then moves out and forms a third relationship with a second woman, is that to be a family as well? And the problem is that that will bring absolute chaos to family law. You'll have competing groups saying that they have this family status in the Constitution, that they're entitled to be regarded as that, and that a man, for instance, could be the male partner in two families contemporaneously.
He's lost me now.
And there is a serious issue arising from that in terms of what is the family, because it will remain one way or the other described in the Constitution as the fundamental unit group of society and the necessary basis of social order. And if you define it in that way and allow people to move in and out of them and to create new families without even getting a divorce decree or making adequate provision for the people in the previous relationship, then you're moving towards chaos rather than social order.
You get that, you understand? I think I kind of get the gist of it. So that's the Family Amendment. Now, the Care Amendment, right, would remove the so-called a woman's place is in the home clause. Yeah, would remove the woman's place in the home clause in the Constitution. They would add a new clause saying the state recognises that the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of the bonds that exist among them gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved and shall strive to support such provision. What does he make of this, Michael McDowell? He's urging people to vote no, no, kneel, kneel.
Well, the great majority of Irish women, I believe, and I think this will be borne out in tomorrow's referendum, do not regard the recognition of the contribution they make to society by parenting in the home as in any way demeaning or rendering them second-class citizens. What is being removed from the Constitution is an obligation on the state to respect the right of women who want to parent in the home not to be forced by economic necessity to leave the home. And our Constitution clearly recognises the right of women, if they choose to work outside the home, to do so. Article 45 of the Constitution says that all citizens, men and women equally, have the right to earn their livelihoods outside the home. So what we're dealing with here is a proposal which this referendum was timed for International Women's Day.
Well, yeah, and three parties led by men. It's not a great look that this is being decided that way, is it not?
That was strange enough, but, you know, and they're saying, you know, it's strange on International Women's Day if this was rejected. But the great majority of women, I think, will vote against it. And I think that Sunday, which is International Mother's Day, will be the day on which they voted against a proposal to remove all reference to mothers from the Irish Constitution. Okay.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that shortly. Not exclusively, by the way. There's much to get into with Melissa Shumay. This is Thursday's Richie Allen Show. I'm Richie Allen. It's exactly 20 minutes past the hour of 4 o'clock. So that's the referendum. I'm going to read some of your comments now briefly. Hi to Ardal, who says, Richie, have you seen the Wikipedia new definition of Great Reset? I haven't, no. He says, apparently, according to Wikipedia, it was devised post-COVID-19 to stimulate economic recovery. I found this out as the term Great Reset triggers a context warning on YouTube, says Ardal. Thank you, Ardal. Hi to Sam, who says, we had those drones a few years ago as well, Richie, and they're not small either. You could clearly see them even at the distance they were away. You could see them in the sky, says Sam. That's right, Sam. Nobody's been asked their permission. Policing is supposed to happen by consent. You often hear various commissioners, when they talk about policing, they say to their interviewers, they say, well, we police by consent. But they're doing these things without asking people permission. You know, people have a right to privacy within reason. I know things have changed. I know 2024 is not 1976, but people do have some right to privacy. People do have some right not to be followed by the state using cameras and drones and whatever else they devise. But yeah, if you pick up any newspaper, and you don't need to pick up a newspaper, you can go online and put in, enter the search term, drone and delivery. And when you get your results, then filter out news, or filter everything out except news. And you'll see that this is a common thing in the last couple of years. The big delivery companies, they've already got the drones ready to go that can deliver your Amazon products. Wasn't the COVID scam an absolute gift to Jeff Bezos, wasn't it? And to Amazon. When you think about it, has anybody else benefited more? Forget the pharmaceutical companies. Is there anybody on planet Earth who's done better out of the scamdemic than Jeff Bezos? I can't imagine. I was talking with a very good friend of mine on the phone after the programme yesterday, and both of us were talking about being, well, we're basically surrounded by Amazon trucks. Remember that old question about marketing, not marketing, but product success? Remember, we used to measure product success by how far away you are geographically from a certain product. So they talked about Coca-Cola. You're never more than a few metres away from Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. You're never more than half a kilometre away from McDonald's or Burger King or whatever. You've got to say, Amazon has got to be the most successful business in the world, right? By the way, I'm not being ironic when I say that. I'm not being stupid either. I'm trying to think, is there a more successful business? The trucks are everywhere. I do my 5, sometimes 6 mile run 7 days a week. I do. I enjoy it. It's not good for my knees, but I enjoy it. And I see Amazon vans pretty much every 5 minutes. It's amazing. And they want to put their drones in the sky too. And obviously those drones will be equipped with cameras. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to navigate, would they? It's absolutely incredible what's coming. Hello, Claire. The family referendum is the more dangerous of the two. She says our constitution is the foundation stone of all of our laws. Its wording needs to be clear and not up to interpretation. I'm voting no in both because it would be legal chaos going forward otherwise, says Claire. Thank you, Claire. Yeah, have I time to do one quick story? You know, the Levelling Up Secretary, Michael Gove, has been handed the task of redefining extremism in the UK. They want to broaden the term, they want to broaden what an extremist is, broaden out the terminology so that they can accuse anybody of extremism and then punish them. This is by their own admission. This is what they're saying. It's not me picking out you know, what it's not me misreading it. This is what they want to do. Now, funnily enough, at the moment, David Baddiel, he's a very, very unusual character, Baddiel. He's a weirdo. I tweeted Baddiel a couple of years ago, and at the time it got a bit of traction, and my tweet resulted in Baddiel changing his bio on his Twitter page. Baddiel used to refer to himself as a Jewish atheist, and I tweeted him and said, that's impossible. You cannot be a Jewish atheist. If you're an atheist, you're not Jewish. Jews are not a race. You're not a separate ethnic group to me or anybody else. Well, not anybody else, but to me, most of you are white people. So anyway, he didn't answer Baddiel, which I thought was quite rude, because not long before that, his production company had invited me to take part in a documentary about anti-Semitism, which I was all for, but they wouldn't allow me film my interview. Anyway, long story short, so he changed his bio to read Jew. I tweeted him back and said, right, have you been converted? I got no response. He's an arsehole, David Baddiel. Generally, he is. He's a failed comedian. He's a piss-poor writer. And he's found a cause. That's what people do. Some people, when whatever they were famous for has deserted them, and Baddiel was carried by Frank Skinner for years, he's not funny at all. And that's a subjective opinion. I'm well aware of that. Some people might find him funny. But Baddiel does what a lot of people do. To remain in the public eye, you've got to grab onto some cause or other. Baddiel wants us to believe that the UK is awash with anti-Semitism, which it isn't. He's currently making a podcast with Saeeda Warsi. You know who she is, don't you? She's in the House of Lords these days, Labour peer, isn't she? Saeeda Warsi, Muslim woman, I believe. Anyway, he was on Sky News again, Sky News today, to talk about this. And Baddiel is so stupid, he said this. He's talking about extremism. Listen.
It's very, very difficult, and perhaps the government are wrong, to have a notion that you can just define a word like extremism in a very wide way. Because
that sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds like Baddiel is on our side. It's wrong for the government to try and broaden out what extremist is. You know, you think, good, good, go on, Dave.
Because the point is, truth is in the detail, right?
And if well done, truth is and should be in the detail.
Truth is in the detail, then there are ways in which every community gets stereotyped, gets exaggerated by, that referring specific to them, for example.
Yes, 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 David Baddiel is talking sense. Every community gets stereotyped. The amount of times over the years, and it's happened many a time, that I've been in company with people from other parts of the world, and they've made wisecracks about drinking. And sure, Richie will drink you under the table. You know, this Irish thing. And the Irish are stupid. Just laugh it off, right? Stereotypes. Good, good. We can't be stereotyping. Or we should accept that people stereotype us and just get on with it. But he's not saying that. Listen to what he says.
Example, the notion that Jews are in control of the world and that Jews are secretly manipulating, you know, power and politics and all the rest of it. That's pretty specific to Jews.
It is. It's a specific Jewish trope. The Jews are evil people. Most people don't say evil. They just say the Jews. Yeah, they run everything. It's been around for a long time. It's never harmed any Jew that I know. So we should just laugh it off, shouldn't we? We shouldn't be labelling somebody as an extremist if they say, Asher, the Jews have loads of money. I never met a poor Jew. Asher, the Rothschilds run everything. It's no big deal, really, is it? It hasn't hurt any Jew that you've ever met, right? Right?
And therefore, if someone was saying that, that would be a specific way in which their extremism would be targeting towards Jews.
You dickhead. You absolute dickhead. It is an extremism. You know, Christ Almighty. When I was younger, ma'am, can I have a few pee to buy a bar of chocolate? What do you think I am, a Rothschild? That extremist, was it? It's a stereotype, man. It's like saying Jews have big noses. They don't. Not a single accountant working for Accounts Direct in Manchester. My accountants, all of them Jewish lads. Big firm of friends. All grew up together. Not a single big nose. I've remarked upon this when I've been in there meeting the lads. Where's your noses, lads? That's a stereotype. It hasn't done any harm, has it? 29 minutes past the hour. I'm not going to labour the point. You understand where I'm coming from. It isn't extremist to say the Jews are running the world. Now, if you could link that to harm to the Jews, I might agree with you. But the Jews are doing okay, by their own admission. This is the Richie Allen Show. Time for a tune. When we come back, Melissa Shumay will be live and will be dangerous. Live and dangerous, that's the one. Music from Starship. Music from Starship, from the soundtrack to the film Cocktail, starring Brian Brown, Elizabeth Shue and Tom Cruise. I can't remember who directed it, but it's one of the greatest films of all time. It won 17 Oscars back in 1988. It didn't win an Oscar. This is the Richie Allen Show. It is the most listened to independent news radio show in the world. It's Thursday's edition. I am delighted to be with you, even though the old voice is struggling a wee bit. Back in 3 minutes. Right, it's 29 to the top of the hour. That's Starship and Wild Again, the Richie Allen Show. Melissa Shue May is an academic and a financial investor and a friend of the programmes. She's going to be with us for the next 35 to 40 minutes. It's a pleasure to have you back, Melissa. First time this year, I think. How are you?
I'm doing good. All good. How are you?
Actually, I'm not too shabby at all. I'll be watching with great interest tomorrow the referendum on the Irish Constitution, the Family Amendment and the Care Amendment. It's looking close, Melissa. What do you think of it? What are your thoughts?
I think that if you set aside virtue, who actually benefits from it? That's, I think, the question that people should really be asking, because it's completely based on virtue and gaslighting the Irish population into this belief that the Constitution is set up to say that a woman's place is in the home, and single parents and cohabiting couples are not protected under the realm of the law. They are. So who does it actually protect? It could be quite detrimental, if you ask me, particularly if you look at, if you make so there's no definition for durable relationships. So what is a durable relationship? What is a sustained period of time? If that is matched with marriage, does that not mean that there's no opting out of marriage? You choose to marry. A lot of people have chosen not to marry because of the contractual agreement of a marriage. So what about the implications for that for family law, for inheritance, and for taxation? So you could have somebody that you were in a durable relationship come after you for maybe that those things that you would have only achieved through marriage. So it's kind of taken the option to not marry away. And nobody seems to be concerned with that. If you don't have a definition for it, it's up to the courts to decide what the definition is for it. So what is it really about? Who does it benefit? It's the Irish Constitution. There's no definition within the Irish Constitution for it, but there is an EU definition in regards to immigration, and it's for right of residence. So regardless of the implications that this could have for the citizens of Ireland, this is for me to bring in the wives, children, non-wives, multiple wives of those immigrants that are already here, to further expand the Irish population of immigrants. Then when you look at what they're doing with taking out the term mother, well, that term was actually, if you read the Constitution, it's actually beautiful the way it's put in, but that term was put in to protect mothers so that they could actually be at home
and prioritizing raising children without having to abandon the raising of the children and managing the home to go, because they had to go to work to earn money. That protection was there. Yeah, Michael McDougall put it eloquently when he spoke to Sky News this afternoon. He said, you know, I don't know if that, he said, basically he said he didn't know of any woman who felt that they were being subjugated. You know, any woman who lives, who stays at home, who raises the children, that they were somehow second class citizens or that they were somehow oppressed. He put it very well. On the possibility that people claiming international protection in Ireland, they might be able to bring people in then, a wife or wives and extended family. I just have to say this, I'm not stupid, and I know you're far from stupid. The government says it's got nothing to do with any of that. It says that basically families have changed. That's what they say. Families have changed. We saw the family dynamic in Ireland years ago. It generally was a man, a woman, and 2.4 children. It's now anything and everything. It's same-sex couples. As you said, Melissa, it's single parents. So that's, I'm not going to say any more. That is what they say. But I see how, what you said, I see how it could be abused. Am I right in saying, by the way, that 20% of Ireland's population, which is just over 5 million now, 20% today were not born in Ireland. Is that right? I think that's right, isn't it? Something along those lines.
I'm not sure about the Ireland figures, but I was looking at the UK figures, and since 2008, from GFC in 2008, the population, there's been 10 million immigrants from then.
That's right.
And the current population of the UK is 67 million. 17 million of those are immigrants, and the ONS have projected, I think, by 2036 for that to further increase by the population to increase by 6.6 million, 6.1 million of those to be immigrants. So there is a complete dilution of society.
And that's about the size of two large cities a year, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The net migration last year was just over 600,000, which is two very large cities, really, if you want to put it like that. And do you subscribe to those who say that one of the reasons for doing this, for changing the demographics of countries, is to divide people so that the agendas that you've been talking about now for some time online on your Facebook page, which of course we'll put links to on the podcast notes, that it's to set people against one another so that we might maybe miss or maybe not really understand what the bigger picture is. Is that why they do these things, in your opinion?
I think that there's several reasons. If you can't have a world government with strong nations, so you have to dilute nations. With immigration, there is that element of different cultures, because if you're culturally different, you do tend to
keep yourself to yourself,
be racist towards each other.
Yeah, of course.
So with that chaos from the streets, that kind of makes the middle earners call to the top to do something. And if you just give up more of your freedoms, it's more top-down authority. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is, for me, potentially labour force, because there is a global restructuring. And if you look, particularly in Ireland, Ireland was one of the poorest in Western Europe and went in the 90s and went to being one of the richest. That was achieved through, one of the reasons for that was increased women in the labour force, which also, when you don't protect mothers to stay at home, there's going to be more mothers forced out to work. And low corporation tax. The low corporation tax, the tax haven of Ireland, is coming to an end. They actually have to increase their corporate tax from 12.5% to 15%. That started this year. So it
from
seems
Brussels.
That there would be a rejig.
From Brussels, right? Yeah. That's a Brussels directive, yeah.
It's it's only for businesses that are generating, I think, over €750,000. And the idea is that that's that accounts for 99% of the businesses are under that. But it's the ones that are above that, which are why Ireland has, that has been the essence of the Celtic Tiger. So there are going to be changes happening in Ireland. So there could also be that idea that they're rejigging the population for workers.
And what will they do? Melissa Shumay is our guest. Melissa's an investor and an academic. These workers, what will they do? Because manufacturing has basically, over the last 2 to 3 decades, disappeared, you could say, from Britain and from Ireland. Financial services jobs are going to be taken by artificial intelligence. I'm pretty certain of that. Now, you feel free to contradict me. And lots of jobs will be taken by artificial intelligence. What will people do? What do you imagine people will do to earn a living in 20 years' time?
It will have to go back. We have delegated production to China, to India.
Yeah.
It's going to have to come back here, because in order to trade within the world. The BRICS are forming a stronger and stronger alliance, so it seems that the world is breaking in two. So the West will have to move back into production. And there's so many now that are so pampered that they just want to put on suit and tie and go and make 100,000 a year, that they just would not be accustomed to the idea of going out and actually working again. And like I say, I think that that's also part of what this bill is being proposed, to force more women out into the workplace. And then you have the immigrants coming in that maybe come from somewhere that isn't as prosperous as we are. And now, to the credit of a lot of the ones are coming in, and they are so keen to work and they are productive. The issue is the ones that are completely non-vetted. But then that's your digital ID being introduced, because we need a digital ID. There's so many people, there's so much crime. You know, we're going to need this digital ID to progress forward.
And we can't just foist the digital ID on the immigrant arrivals into the country, because that's racist. So everybody's going to have it. I want to ask you.
Well, even if you did, you did only bring it onto the people coming into the country, that is now such a percentage of the population that it's very easy to then move it towards the tipping point.
It would be, wouldn't it? A number of people got in touch with me today when I'd mentioned you were coming back, to do with the US dollar, to ask you about the US dollar. A guy was on a program called USA Watchdog. And this has been given to me by a friend of mine. When the US dollar, this is what the guy said, he's an economist, I believe. When the US dollar is dethroned as the world reserve currency, there are three things you want to hold on to. Everything but the US dollar. The first thing is God's money. Number one would be silver. Number two would be gold. The third thing is not God's money, it's Bitcoin. Bitcoin. So silver, gold and Bitcoin. Bitcoin is going to go crazy because other countries will not accept the dollar as payment. People are going to want to be paid in something that is real, like gold, silver and crypto currencies. What do you say to that? Because I'm very confused about cryptocurrencies, and I always saw them as a kind of a Trojan horse to get people to think that they were independent of big states, big countries, but that in reality, I felt they were conditioning people to accept a world of a cashless world. So what do you think of that, gold, silver and Bitcoin?
I think that Bitcoin was one of the first attempts at a one world currency. So, I mean, that would make me suspicious. It's not a bad idea to hold it, particularly not over this past month. But it's numbers on the screen. Are people actually cashing out? They're all vulnerable to, my issue with Bitcoin is that they can tax you at the exit point up to 99. They can tax you whatever they want, or they can absolutely eliminate it. So it is at the mercy of regulation. With silver and gold, also they can make them somewhat illegal. They have before. I don't think that that's going to happen because so few people actually hold silver and gold. It's actually anything real and anything that's tangible, because what's happening right now is that there's a real asset and the world has been built, particularly since 71, to come up the gold standard, this financialization, where that asset, they borrowed against it, they insured against it, they betted against it, and they built a house of cards just continuing to do that. And that's the house of cards that has fallen down. And that's why they're going after, that's why central banks countries are prolifically buying up gold. Gold, there's a gold-silver ratio, so when gold goes up, silver goes up more. That's the same thing with Bitcoin. When Bitcoin goes up, the other cryptos go up more.
I'm with you. So central banks are buying up gold at the moment. But, yeah. but you said
yeah, they have been for years.
They have been for years.
Tier one asset. It's a tier one asset that's now considered the same thing as money.
Now you may.
So Bitcoin isn't a tier one asset.
So Bitcoin is not a tier one asset, right? This is very interesting, because you have, I think you've probably scared quite a number of our listeners. Don't be worried about that. You call it as you see it. But a number of our listeners are buying gold and silver. they're buying physical gold and silver, as well as investing in gold and silver. And they'd be very worried now to hear you say that they could make it illegal. And listening to that, that's a bit scary. I suppose what they could do is they could devalue it, couldn't they?
They can make anything illegal. It's very difficult to devalue gold at this stage because in an everything bubble, what has not gone up, what has not performed? Silver and gold. So if you look at Bitcoin in the past couple of years with what's happened, gold, the money that would have went to silver and gold has gone to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin can be wiped out. We've seen the other day that all the social media platforms went down. So where's your Bitcoin when you can't access it? So it's not a bad idea to hold it. What I would tell people, I've always told people from the start, I mean, I have my suspicions about it because of the time that it came out. So, and then you have BlackRock prolifically buying it up. So how is that decentralized? One of the most centralized entities on the planet is now one of the number one holders. And then you had Michael Saylor at MicroStrategies had one in 170 Bitcoin. He owned it, so that's not really a fair system. It should be choices. So I would hold silver. I personally don't hold any Bitcoin right now. I would hold silver and gold. I would hold land. I would hold properties. I would hold things that are actually real assets. Now again,
property and land.
The plan is for them to go after. Yeah. The plan is for them to go after these real assets. You know, they're making that clear. If you look at, they're getting that in through the right to housing. They're doing it in California. They're attempting it in Ireland as well, where it's a beautiful idea that everybody should have a right to a house. Absolutely. But is there the resources to provide that? No. So they're going to have to take the resources from the people. And if you look, the state was the idea in Ireland was to delimit the rights to private property.
That's right for the common good. In fact, a guest of mine got into this last night. Here's one from Mark. He says, Richie, ask Melissa, and we've already gotten into it, but he says about Bitcoin, how it went to an all-time high this week, $69,000, and yet it still has its detractors saying it is or was dead. People have been saying that since 2012 when it was $10. That's what Mark says. Mark is all in favour of it and says, look at it. Look at how high it's gone, $69,000 this week. Is that what it is for one Bitcoin? 69 grand.
Yep. Yeah. But this is the thing, people don't tend to cash out. Now, with it going up, I would say that it has done boom, bubble, bust multiple times. So while it can't be manipulated internally, it can be manipulated externally. So you have BlackRock coming out and announcing that their holdings, and then the price goes up. And people don't want to buy it. It was down there, I think, around 40,000, maybe. I think it went lower. Then people are interested again now that it's gone up. People will buy in right now thinking, oh, Bitcoin's it's the way to go. And they're the ones that are going to lose out because then it'll just drop again and it'll keep doing that. But it's vulnerable. What I've told anybody to do with crypto is, so say you wanted to put £2,000, just say, into crypto. And whatever it is, Bitcoin it's different. The other ones, they're all speculative assets. Pull out your principal and the rest is gravy. So if it's gone up, if you had a 2,000 in and it's gone up to 4,000, pull out your 2,000 and then let it run.
This is very good advice.
It's a speculative asset. Speculate on it.
This is good advice. This is like when I used to live in Spain and I went to the casinos all the time. Gamble with their money. So if you have a couple of good hands of blackjack, put the money you brought with you, put it in your back pocket and leave it there forever and play with the winnings and drink their free drinks and play with their money. Yeah. I like this. So if you put a couple of grand into Bitcoin, it does well. Cash out your £2,000, do something else with that that's positive, and then play with their money. I've just been very skeptical. I lost a lot of, I didn't lose friends, but in the early days of this programme 10 years ago, there were some listeners who turned away from the programme because they couldn't understand why I wouldn't be all in favour of Bitcoin. I had this idea at the time that it's cashless and eventually they want us to be cashless. And I said to a guy one time on the show, Melissa, he came on to talk about it and he was a very nice guy. He was a very eloquent guy. Like yourself, he knew his stuff, you know. And I said to him, what's to stop governments in the future basically saying Bitcoin is not legal tender? What is to stop governments from telling businesses you must not accept Bitcoin as legal tender? I mean, that is something that could conceivably happen. Or am I talking garbage?
Well, that's absolutely what can happen, because that's what they've done before. That's what they actually did with gold in America.
Yeah.
So it's very conceivable. But right now, it's a non-issue, because there is some countries that are in hyperinflation that are using Bitcoin or the US dollar. But on the whole, I mean, I don't know anybody. I've never been offered by anybody to purchase anything in Bitcoin. So there's no velocity behind it. People are not using it as a currency. They're only using it as a speculative asset that they are calling a store of wealth. But it's so volatile that it can't really be a store of wealth. It's not used as a currency. So you have to be honest and say what it is a speculative asset. And there's a lot of people that have made a lot of money out of it, but it is still, the more people that buy it, the more the value goes up. So, you know, there's your little, who's the money coming from and who's the money going to. And right now it's BlackRock.
BlackRock. Yeah, BlackRock. Spoke a bit yesterday on the programme about the privatisation campaign of the British government from the 1970s up until today, and the part played in that by George Osborne, who went on to get a very cushy little job working a couple of hours a week for BlackRock and earning a six-figure salary, and all the stuff that went on. It's one of the most corrupt institutions in the world, BlackRock, yet nobody wants to take it on. Not the FBI, nobody. I mean, they were, talk about insider trading. You know, don't you, Melissa, that when Osborne was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, they knew that Carillion had issued a share price warning. They knew Carillion was in dire straits. And yet the government gave Carillion contracts, even though they knew the company was going to collapse. While that was happening, Osborne was telling his pals at BlackRock to short Carillion. Now, in most other societies, the person who does that goes to jail. You know, it's one of the most filthy... It's a behemoth, isn't it, BlackRock, isn't it? It's far bigger than even I can imagine. But like, when we're talking about managing assets, what sort of scale are we talking about, Melissa?
Oh, they are, if there were a country, they'd be the third largest in the world behind the US and China. So that's the scale of BlackRock. And we fund them. Nobody can take them on, because if you do, you're going to collapse.
Yeah.
Pensions, that, you know, that's your pension. We're feeding the beast. Your pension is with them in some capacity.
Looking at
they dictate.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, really. It's worth a deep dive for anybody to get into BlackRock and what it is and what it does. You're listening to Melissa Shumay. You know who Melissa is. You'll find her on Twitter. You'll find her on Facebook. I'll put the links on a little bit later on. That budget announcement, like all budget announcements, absolutely farcical yesterday here in London. I'm not in London, obviously. I'm in Salford, wasn't it? What do you think? What my projection is hardly a brave one. It looks almost, you know, a nailed on certainty that the Labour Party will either lead the next government on their own, or they'll be in coalition with the Lib Dems and the Greens, but it's going to be Labour. What do you expect will happen then when Labour gets in terms of these agendas we talk about? Will these things be expedited? You know,
yes.
Yeah, things like bail-ins, things like we're broke, we've got to take more of your money. Councils are going to charge you far more for your council tax and give you far less. We're going to see a big squeeze, are we?
I don't know if they will take that angle, because right now they know that it's the gig is over, so they can just, you know, romance everybody and keep on printing money. And, you know, you just have to get your digital ID. You just have to get into the prison that we're building for you, the digital ID and CBDC prison. But so they may not go down that route at all. They may just push towards complete socialism.
Right.
I mean, they're kind of backed, they're backed into a corner now. The UK economy is in recession. The printed trillions causing inflation, and that was without stimulating growth or wealth. So that's where we are right now. How do you get out of it? Well, you can't reduce interest rates, or that will have an effect on inflation, but they're going to have to reduce interest rates a little bit. We're moving into a historical year where nearly 50% of the population are going to be voting. So that could create a shift in itself. But they're all between this kind of catch 22. So there's nothing that Labour can do. There's no pulling this back. The right thing to do, honestly, would be to move towards austerity. They are spending way, way too much, but there's no way out of this without a takeover of our assets, is how they see that they're going to.
Yeah, because austerity will mean that whatever is left of public services, the public services will just collapse completely. And then you're into chaos, then serious chaos. I mean, they're in, when we talk about public services, we're obviously talking mostly about the National Health Service. We're talking about education, underfunded. You'll have seen this. Birmingham City Council wants to hike its council tax rate by 40%. They want to levy a 40% increase on people who live in Birmingham. And they've been very open about this. They say, and by the way, we're going to do a whole lot less. Now, to be honest with you, Melissa, apart from taking our bins once every 3 weeks, I don't know what they do here in Salford. For me, to be honest, our streets are full with litter. Salford's like a ghetto now. And I love the place. I really do love the place. I love the people of Salford. But it's like a ghetto. It looks like something from a war zone, with litter everywhere, overturned bins. I've seen rats. Never seen anything like it. And it's the same here in Salford. They're going to put it up by 5%, which is the maximum they're allowed to, unless they get special dispensation. And here in Salford, they're saying the same thing. We're going to do a lot less for you. These are scary times.
They have to put up taxes. The reality of the situation is the only way to bring down inflation, because this is cost push inflation. People's food bill has gone up double. People's electricity has gone up nearly double. So that leaves less money in their pockets to go out and spend on these middle earner businesses that are actually keeping the economy afloat. So they're going to have to go after taxes. That's my thesis on CBDCs. The purpose of CBDCs is to tax at a maximum percentage to try in some semblance to manage a budget. And when they get that in, they can tax you at will. But the only way that they can bring down this inflation is by not printing money, which is to raise taxes. But people are squeezed dry as it is.
Yeah.
There's nothing left for them to take. People are now at that stage where they're having to make decisions. It's not about, you know, going into a lower brand in the supermarkets. It's, you know, do I need this?
Yeah, living without. You know what you just said there? Can I ask you to repeat it? It's very important. What Melissa said there. So one of the big things about central bank digital currencies, the complete removal of cash and it being the online pound, and people don't talk about this, but Melissa does, it is that the taxation then is instant. There's nothing you can do to protect your money. It is instant. Every transaction is not only discoverable, but every transaction is programmable, absolutely, instantly. And then they can hike up taxes to whatever they bloody want and do it. And that's what I see when the next government comes in, is they're going to start talking about, you know, I even think bail-ins, to be honest.
Tax the rich.
Yeah.
I think they'll move towards tax the rich, but they don't mean actually tax the rich, because the rich don't pay taxes. The rich pay the politicians. The wealthy pay good accounts, and the actual workers pay taxes. So they're going to be taking more and more taxes off the workers. How are they going to do that? It's going to have to be through their property, because they have their income so stretched that it will be like council tax, like virtue taxes for ULEZ. And now with this hate speech, you know, redefinition of extremism, if you look at what's happening in Canada, you know, there's $20,000 fines, and they'll do it through that. It'll be done through virtue taxes, but it's taxes nonetheless, carbon taxes, etc. So it's they're just going to squeeze you dry until there's nothing. I just wonder at what point will people start to fight back.
Yeah, the dream is that when middle class, I hate to use the class system, I'm a working class lad from Ballybeg in Waterford, but in their system of class, it was always believed that the middle earners, people who always had enough, mm-hmm. people who could afford a holiday a year, they weren't rich, mm-hmm. but that if you screwed with that people, with those people, that there'd be a revolution. You know, the people who trusted society, who trusted the authorities in society, and who always got on okay, they had a decent job and could put their kids through school. The idea was if you pulled the rug out from under those people, middle income earners, that you'd have a revolution on your hands. Please God, that's true, Melissa, to be honest.
It doesn't seem to be, because those people are very, very comfortable. I don't like class either. That's why I refer to low earners and middle earners because I prefer the middle earner class. But the idea is to move back towards a feudal system where, like I say, it's you will own nothing, be happy. That's one thing. But you will rent what you need. You need, really need to pay particular attention to that, because we're moving into a subscription economy. So they don't need these middle earners anymore. They want to move back towards feudalism, the whole idea of capitalism for the middle earners has collapsed, and they're going after the actual assets of the middle earners, and they will get them and then they will rent them back to you. And I'm seeing that. I was wondering why housing hadn't really collapsed, because under section 24 landlords are bailing out of the market. Under section 24, it's between section 24 and the interest rate hikes, it's just not profitable for landlords anymore. And it's your regular everyday landlords, it's your person that bought the house for a pension rather than, you know, these Lloyds and BlackRock landlords. So why is there not a crash just with landlords bailing out of the market? They're moving into co-ownership. So they're kind of getting that idea into your head, where you own a proportion of the house and you rent a portion of the house, because they're moving back into a rental society of properties again. And the purpose of that is that when you don't own your property, if you look at the Chinese social credits system, if you don't own your property, you have absolutely no rights. So if it's only a rental society, you can be shut out of that society. You can't go back to the property that you own and say, no, I'm not doing that, because you can be put out of that property.
Communitarianism is a term I've heard quite a bit. You mentioned socialism earlier on. I'm a student, or I was for many years, of socialism. I think what you have with Labour, we often call it democratic socialism. It's not really socialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll know your history. You'll know people like Salvador Allende and Hugo Chavez. They didn't steal from the rich to give to the poor. They didn't. What they did was proper socialism. They nationalized the assets of the state. They kicked out all the corporations and the globalists. They told the wealthiest people in the economy, listen, just look after the staff. Just give them a good medical package and pension, and you don't have to fear us. And they didn't. They didn't have to fear Allende and Chile. I dream of these people, to be honest. But we don't have anybody like that in politics today. The political system isn't set up anyway, you know, for those people to
survive. The problem with socialism is that if it the person, there has to be virtue attached to it. And there's a particular kind of personality that tends to get into positions of power. And they're psychopaths, sociopaths.
Yeah. Today, for sure. And
yeah, so it starts off as a genuinely virtuous idea, but it quickly evolves into a feudal-like system.
No doubt about it. No doubt.
It's because people don't keep a check on it. People take it for granted and don't keep a check on it. And it's the most charismatic person that comes out for election that will win the election. And really, it's about who's going to give you the most free stuff and who has the most charisma.
You know, back in
rather than actual policy.
Yeah, back in the day, the genuine socialists of Latin America, they didn't give a damn who you went to bed with, what your sexuality was. They didn't give a damn which god you prayed to. As far as they were concerned, died in the wool real social. I urge my listeners to find out about people like Salvador Allende. They didn't care. They felt it was none of the state's business what you were getting up to in your personal life, so long as it wasn't interfering with children. None of your business. That's how they operated. It's spooky. Can I ask you this? And we've got about 3 minutes left today. Thanks for coming back on. It's always an education. And I do mean that. Thanks for your time, Melissa. Knowing that it's where they want to take us can be debilitating. It can be depressing. Does it depress you? Or are you still glass half full? There is time to write this, you know, course, if you want to see it as a big ship sailing, to write this course and for people to take back, you know, their human rights, their rights to live, to have an experience of life like maybe we did at one time or another, not to go down this kind of dystopian path. Is there time to reverse this?
I don't think that, listen, the reset's happening. There's no negotiation on that. The reset is happening. Either we take control of it or it will be decided by this collection of billionaires. But they're in a race. I mean, they're trying to pass through all of these bills, legislation, trying to completely transform society really, really quickly when generally they always did it really slowly in increments. That's because the House of Cards that I spoke about earlier is in free fall. The collapse is happening. So I don't think it's going to work in their favor because people are going to realize pretty quickly what they're coming after. And people, historically, people do stand up against it. It would just really be nice if people would realize it now and do something about it now instead of waiting to the pain. And that's why you need to be prepared for a little bit of unrest. But we've been here before historically and we always get through it. It's not the end of the world. And for everything that you think that you own anyway, you don't. Die tomorrow. See what you own.
Well, I tell you what, yeah, there might be a bloody nose for the Irish government tomorrow. Let's hope there is. I'll be watching that with.
I really, really hope so, because it's time for them to realise that the people of Ireland, they need to send a clear message that the people of Ireland have had enough. These things are brought through. It's vague. It's costly. And people need to say absolutely no. Vote no to protect mothers from economic attack. Vote no to protect your rights to opt in or out of marriage. Vote no.
Great to have you back on the programme. Have a great weekend, Melissa. I'll put links to where you can find Melissa. I know most of our listeners will know, but I will on the podcast notes. Thanks again, and I look forward to next time. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Richie.
Lovely to have you back. Melissa Shumay, live on Thursday's Richie Allen Show. Pay attention to her. I'll put links to the Facebook page on the notes, as I said, a bit later on. The time is fast approaching 9 minutes past the hour of 5 o'clock. A lot of comments on that, right? Quickly, as quick as I can. This one from Chris. Bitcoin is a trading vehicle and a volatile one at that. It isn't a long-term store of wealth, in my opinion, says Chris. Hello to Will B. Put up taxes for whom, he says. Not working people. Don't tax income. Tax wealth ownership. Don't put a tax on people's houses, says Will B. Hi to Nelly. Council tax up by 50%. Maybe it's a ploy to see how folk respond to this madness, testing the waters to see how far they can push. Nelly, it's the Birmingham are asking. Birmingham have asked permission. I don't know if Birmingham City Council, if the authority has received an answer, but it wants permission to hike council tax by 40% because it is in such debt at the moment. Look it up yourself online. I'm pretty sure it's a 40% hike thereafter. The law says that 5% is the maximum. They can increase it by year on year. Salford Council have said here they will be raising it by 5% for everybody. And it is significant. I mean, it really is significant, especially when you don't have very much. Hi to Jack, who says, when 90% of your money supply is already digital, created whenever a bank makes a loan, The way to correct this is to call for a permanent money, says Jack. Thank you, Jack, for that. I appreciate it. Gaz says, in the end, everyone will work from home. I posed that question to Melissa earlier. What will people do in this mad dystopian world they're building? Okay, right. I'm going to take a tune. When I come back, we're going to be chatting with Sophie Ottaway. I'm looking forward to a really nice person. Nice lady is Sophie. Her gender was changed when she was born, and it was kept secret from her for the best part of 20 years, more than 20 years, and she only discovered what had happened when she went on a visit, when she went to see her doctor. She went public about this last year. It's an important story. It has implications for other people, and we're going to talk about it when we come back from this from Whitney Houston. That's right. Yes, it's working today. Things are working today, smoothly today for a change. I'm Richie Allen, by the way. Thank you for supporting your Richie Allen show. Details on how to do that, go to richieallen.co.uk, where it says support your show, support your show. It's the time now, exactly 11 minutes past 5 o'clock. Yes, it is. Yeah, Whitney Houston and How Will I Know on the Richie Allen Show. The time is 14 minutes past the hour of 5 o'clock. Thank you for your messages. Thank you for using the app. Download the app if you haven't before. You can send a message instantaneously. The second you press send, it arrives here in the studio. Anne says, how can bricklayers work from home? It's a good point, Anne. I think the plan is for even more and more people to work from home in years to come. It's not a healthy thing, in my opinion. And I've been doing it long before COVID, you know, but it's different doing what I do. I'm able to get out and to have a bit of fresh air and get away from the place. But people who work in financial services, having moved away from the office in the last 3-4 years, there are a lot of problems and nobody's really talking about it. But anyway, look, we'll leave that for now. I'm excited to meet my next guest. I really am. She's a quite extraordinary story to tell. And it's an important one. She went public with it last year. I'm not going to tell it again. I've given you the gist of it. We'll let her tell it herself. Let's welcome to the programme Sophie Ottaway. Hello, Sophie. You're very welcome.
Hi, Richie. How are you doing today?
Gosh, I'm not doing too shabby. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I'm a bit like that. I'm one of those. I'm wishing my life away. Looking forward to the weekend instead of just living in the moment, Sophie, which is what I probably need to do
it.
A bit more. Yeah, but no, I'm delighted you're on. And I'm delighted that I found you. I read the story last year in one of the papers and I said I must invite Sophie on, and it never happened. But you've spoken to friends of mine on some pretty great podcasts and shows. So I heard those interviews and I thought, perfect, let's talk about it. 15 years ago or thereabouts, you went to the GP. Most of us go to the GP when we're unwell, when we have one or two problems. That was your case, Sophie, but most of us don't hear or see what you saw when you went to the GP. What happened?
Yeah, so I walked in the GP surgery, age 22, and I knew I'd been born with quite a few urological problems. And I looked on the computer screen and long story short, the words were there that basically told me that I'd been born male. And after my birth, I was born with a condition called cloacal extrophy. It's a rare condition, which is in one in 200,000, so one in 400,000 live births. So it's very rare. Basically, it turns out that I'd been born with a split penis and bladder and bowel on the outside of my body, wholly male birth. And the doctors had decided that it was a great idea to whip everything off and raise me as a female. And that's had, you know, all manner of issues that is caused off the back of that. But that's the short version of the story, Richie.
Do you know what, Sophie? It doesn't, short or long, I mean, you have all the time you want, by the way. I'm on air till 6 o'clock. You can stay with me if you want till 6 o'clock, because it is an amazing story. It's still shocking. Now tell me, so this is back in the mid-1980s. So the doctor saw, oh my God, this baby boy, split penis, organs on the outside of the body. Was it the done thing then to do what they did?
Well, this this is what the doctors love to lean on. You know, these institutions love to lean on. It was the done thing. So we can hide any crime so long as it was the done thing. And you could say the done thing. It was, there was so few of us, you know, one in 400,000 live births. It's not that many. But yes, it was the done thing. And that's what the NHS will say. But there's so many reasons why it was stupid. So urological problem, if essentially bladder and bowel on the outside of your body and the penis is split, as I said before. So I'm 37 years old now. I've still got the urological problem. So they never bothered to fix the urinary incontinence, which is a massive part of cloacal extrophy. But instead, they very quickly managed to remove my testes to put in a fake vagina into a two-day-old baby that later gave me sepsis.
Christ.
And I didn't know the existence of this vagina growing up. I got told I didn't have one. Essentially, there'd been a problem with it after it had been put in at 2 days old. They'd put it back into the body for it to be reabsorbed. And that reabsorbed vagina basically then became a mass in my abdomen, which gave me sepsis years on. So if their idea was, you know, they could give me a better life, the way I see it is they never fixed the original problem, which was a urological problem, but they had a little bit of an experiment at the same time. Let's push on giving this kid some surgery, and later down the line, let's push some hormones down her neck. Not really being truthful about what those were for, because I was taking hormones from the age of 11 or 12, thinking that it was because my ovaries had been damaged and removed. I didn't know at that point that I'd actually been born a boy, and that this was all part of just making sure that the guys, you know, was maintained. It's pretty sickening, to be honest. And as you might understand, I'm not a massive fan of our national NHS.
No, I don't imagine. And by the way, I wasn't in any way endorsing them when I said, was it the done thing? I was not, because things were pretty advanced back in the mid-1980s. And there must have been other options. And as you said, and this is the terrible thing is that they didn't fix the urological problems. They just did not. And you know what you described there as a baby? I don't want to get all esoteric now, but that sort of trauma, Sophie, for a child. Yeah. I mean, that must have some lasting legacy for a baby to go through that. I mean, you must have been in agony as a baby. It must have left some legacy.
I don't remember an awful lot about, like, you know, up until about 4 or 5. But I think things do have a lasting memory. Like, my mum says that when I was, like, an infant, sort of primary school, every time she got the tinfoil out of the cupboard when she was cooking and opened the tinfoil, apparently I had an absolute hissy fit and no one really knew why. And then they spoke to the doctors at some point. Apparently it's because they used to put tinfoil on the operating table. I don't know if that's true or not. But it just shows that sometimes these things, like, you know, you think you're not aware as a baby, but it must be a part of you that your subconscious is actually aware of what's going on.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. Yeah, there's been a lot of studies done on when babies experience a lot of pain and when they've had to have procedures for various problems, congenital or otherwise, that it does stay with them. So going back then to 22 years ago, I mean, no, we're not going back 22 years ago. We're going back 15 years ago, excuse me. So you learned this at the GP surgery. You obviously had a conversation with mum and dad then straight after. What was that like?
Yeah, God. I mean, it was so weird. It was that when I found out, I didn't really know how to process that because I was in the second year of university. There was a lot going on, and I was already a bit of an off the rails kind of character, if you know what I mean. Like, I already had a few issues with drink and I wasn't the best behaved sort of person. So I was already on a knife edge. And when I found that out, I didn't say anything in the surgery because I assumed the locum GP probably would rightfully assume that the patient would actually know their own history.
Yeah.
So she sat there with these notes on the screen, none the wiser that it was the first time I'd seen them. But my mum was at the appointment with me and she knew I'd seen them. Do you know, she knew I'd clocked. And then we got home to the house and they tried to talk to me about it. My dad came home from work early to try and deal with the situation. But at that age, what I did was I just completely shelved it. I didn't want a conversation. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I had to behave in the way that I hadn't read that and I didn't know that, because I just knew that if I was to even start to process that, like, there's no way that I wouldn't just, like, top myself. So to bury that pain during those years, and I really only started to address this whole thing a few years ago, because I landed in hospital and the fake vagina that I didn't know I had nearly killed me, that was the crunch point to start whistleblowing this. At that point, I cracked on with my studies, and then I built a small business, and I leaned on alcohol and drugs really, really heavily, and just buried the problem, which I guess is the big the problem we have in society is that everyone's burying the problems, aren't they?
Yeah. I think. But who could blame you, really? I mean, that's an incredibly... I mean, who could imagine how they'd deal with such a bombshell? I mean, you know, Carlsberg doesn't do bombshells, right? But my God, what a bombshell for you to have to contend with. And did the relationship with mum and dad, so you shelved it. And were you that... You said you shelved it because if you'd confronted it, you really did fear that it would have overwhelmed you and you might have harmed yourself. There's no doubt about that in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, there was conversations and they wanted to speak to me and I was mad. Of course, I was mad. Like, I was fuming. But over time, so from age 22 to, you know, early 30s, mid-30s, there were conversations here and there. And the bulk of the conversations actually happened a couple of years ago when I'd got very, very ill, because at this point I decided I had to handle it. And I had a lot of the arguments with them at that point that I probably should have had 15 years prior. So it was almost like a delayed trauma. And yeah, we've had really hard conversations. I've wanted to know the ins and outs of the why, because making that decision to me seemed like utter madness. And that was where I was sat for ages. How could you make that decision? But when I look at the context, I can see kind of how they were led to make it. And I want to say led to make it, because I don't think, you know, given a fair opportunity, any parent would have chosen to have changed the child's gender. All my parents wanted was the best life. But, you know, in 1986, you've not got the internet, you've not got an iPhone in your pocket. You've got a baby that's just been born and it's got a lot of its organs on the outside of its body. It's got this tiny split penis. It's not looking too healthy. Yeah. And the doctor comes along and says, this is the best option. And there was time pressures as well. So if you think about a cell, you know, any kind of cell, you've got to have a big issue that needs solving and you've got to have the pressure of time. And I can't prove that this is why they did it so quickly, but the surgeries were done within a couple of days of me being born. And I genuinely believe that was to get female onto the birth certificate to not cause any problems. Because I think the way that they evaluated the birth certificate in those days was pick the baby up, have a look at the genitalia. And if it looks male, it's male. If it looks female, it's female. So they weren't lying on the birth certificate when they'd put in a fake vagina into a 2-day-old boy, I guess. So yeah, it was quite a complicated journey.
I was born in 74. So when you were born, I'd have been 14, 15, right? Or coming up for that. Doctors back then, particularly surgeons, were revered. Now, I don't know very much about your mum and dad. I'm sure they're bright. I mean, my parents are bright. My grandparents bright. But they revered these people. I can only imagine when it was put to them by the surgeon, by the expert, that this is the way to go. I can't imagine how they could have done anything different except go, well, we're Mr. and Mrs. Ottaway. What do we know? You know, so yeah.
Absolutely.
It must have been
trust
horrendous.
Trust the experts.
Trust the experts, exactly. Trust the experts. Surgeons, my God. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, when I was in hospital with bronchial issues when I was in my teens, but my grandparents were deferential to these people. It was almost like the Pope would come into the room when a doctor came in or a surgeon, you know, falling over themselves to be really polite, kind of a hushed awe. And I laughed at this. I'm like, this is just somebody who came out of uni with a degree, you know, give over. You know, I mean, they've obviously got some skills, but don't be fawning around them like that. But that's how the people used to act around these people. So I can see it from your parents' point of view as well, is what I'm saying, really.
I agree. I saw something on Twitter earlier. It says, what's the difference between a surgeon and a god? And it said, God doesn't think he's a surgeon.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that before. Absolutely. Pompous people. Not all of them, obviously. But back then they were, because they knew they were revered in society. Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Sophie Ottaway. Sophie was born with a very, very rare 1 in 400,000. Sophie, what's it called again? I can't pronounce it. Go on.
Cloacal extrophy.
Cloacal extrophy. Which meant that Sophie was born with a boy, split penis, and bowel and bladder outside the body. The doctors basically decided that they were going to turn the little boy, into a girl, and performed a number of procedures on Sophie that have left her with lasting serious medical issues. And you, of course, I wanted to ask this a few minutes ago. There's so many questions on my mind. Before we talk about the reasons you came out, you raised the issue. How many others like you are there? Other people, others, that sounded awful. How many other men and women like you are there?
Yeah, no, the others. That's a great question. It's really difficult to know the numbers. Like, so personally, I know of two more, one in England, one in sort of Australia, way on, that were born with the same condition, same thing happened. But so I can't fact check this figure, but somebody approached me the other day and done some research, and they reckon there could be as many as 15,000 across the world with that this has happened to. From my condition, but they also do it to intersex children. But I need to stress that it's not an intersex condition that I've got.
15,000 might have had the surgery that has left them with life-changing medical conditions. And what has been, you said to me at the very top of the conversation, because I tried to do the devil's advocate bit, and I said, well, this was the best procedure at the time. So yep. So they're staying with that. Is anybody giving you any answers? Does anybody want to talk to you? Anybody who was involved or the NHS, do they want to say, okay, we accept you have a genuine grievance, let's sort it out? Has anybody reached out to you?
Richie, the National Homicide Service are absolute expert gaslighters. So I lodged a complaint a couple of years ago into the, the surgeries were actually performed at St. Mary's Hospital in Manchester, and they were performed by two surgeons, one a Mr. Cohen, who's now dead, and a still alive surgeon called Dr. Adrian Bianchi. Now, they performed at St. Mary's Hospital, which is now under the Manchester University Hospitals Foundation Trust. So I put in a complaint a couple of years ago, basically saying, look, I've had sepsis. I've nearly died thanks to a fake vagina I never knew I had. And I never had a vagina all my life. I thought I didn't. And now I found one and it's killing me. And I'm male. It's all nuts. Please, could I have some explanations? And please, can you expedite some care for me? And the complaint came back. You could put more on the back of a fag packet, Richie.
Yeah.
But what I will say is I did have a conversation with the surgeon, Adrian Bianchi. I met with him in Heaton Park. It was an arranged meeting between me and him because we'd had a lot of heated email exchanges. And I met with him, and he did give me the courtesy of meeting with me. And his explanation was that all he wanted to talk about was what if we'd have kept you male, what would have happened, what would have happened then, do you know? And he wanted to play devil's advocate. And the truth is, we'll never know what would have happened. But my argument the whole way through is, if you take your car into the garage and the tires bust, you don't change the engine.
Yeah.
I had a urological problem. It's nothing to do with gender.
Because I can imagine you had all these questions like, why didn't you attempt to reattach or reinsert the organs? And surely you could have found a way to repair my penis. I mean, when those questions were put to Adrian, Mr. Did you say Bianchi? What did he
Adrian
say?
Bianchi, yeah.
What did he say? I mean, because that's what, look, you obviously asked these questions. Why not reinsert the organs? I mean, you're an anatomical expert, you're a surgeon, and try and repair the penis. What was his response?
Well, he said that in those days it would have been impossible to have got the penis to a part that it would have been able to function sexually, and that urologically for urinating, they wouldn't have been able to get the penis to be used for that. So they saw the penis as redundant. That was kind of what they were sitting on. Whether or not that's truth or not, I don't know. I've only got his word to go on, but it seems rather bizarre. I could almost understand that if it was redundant, you might take it off if it was damaged, and then maybe create a way to urinate. That's one thing. But then inserting a fake vagina into a young baby that's never going to be of any use because it's made out of bowel tissue, like that's pretty sickening to me. And then the second thing is, even though you've removed a penis that was broken, That baby is still male.
Yeah.
When you get to the age of 11 or 12 of puberty, surely I should have been given an opportunity to have not taken pills that are going to turn me into a female, do you know? Like, it's nuts.
Yeah, you have a very good argument, a very good case that at that stage somebody should have spoken to you and said, right, this is what happened. And now we're at this crossroads now, you're entering puberty, and this is obviously a very important time, and maybe we need to have a talk about whether we're going to use the female hormones or whatever. But they didn't do that. I suppose that's a conversation you had with mum and dad, I suppose, saying, come on, you know, whatever about you allowing the surgeon to do it, I'm sure you probably had it out with them as to why they didn't speak to you when you were old enough to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you, Richie. I think a lot of the doctors thinking at the time, like I know I've mentioned the doctor's name there, but we have to understand that in the same way that we see in hospitals now, these doctors, and I'm not defending him, why would I? But they, you know, they're painting by numbers, they're using medical pathways. And the pathways for children born with my condition were informed by the work of psychologist John Money, who was over in Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore in America. And he had a nature versus nurture sort of theory. And his theory was that a child's gender is a product of its environment, not as a product of its chromosome. And that theory got massively disproven by lots of other experts. But this guy managed to roll out that theory worldwide. And that seems to be what led us to this place. John Money is now dead. The NHS don't want to take any accountability for it. But, you know, the day will come. I know it will.
It will come. You're absolutely certain of it. And have you spoken to anybody else? Because I asked you and you said about 15,000. Are you in contact with people? Like, in terms of the UK, how many people would there be?
Yeah. So in the UK, so the thing is, it's such a embarrassing personal condition. And we have to remember as well, Richie, that I found out by accident. Nobody bothered to tell me. A lot of these people sitting here might just be thinking, oh, I feel like I'm in the wrong body a bit and I've got urological problems. Do you know, like, because they don't give the name for the condition. I only got the name for the condition five years ago, because if you put cloacal extrophy into Google, you only need to go in a couple of pages to see medical papers that were following the transition journeys of these patients. I firmly believe it was a medical experiment. So I've uncovered two people. One I'm very close friends with, and when he found out, he went back to being male, and then the other person in Australia did exactly the same. I made a slightly different decision. And that's just because how can you possibly trust the same party that did you such injury to repair the situation? Do you know that it's like if he's going to eat at a restaurant, getting food poisoning, you don't go back again.
Is that the main reason, Sophie? Would that be the main reason why you didn't consider the transition back to the sex you were, you know, biologically born? Is that it? Is it down to the fact that they're so incompetent and so useless? That was the main reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about what I'd have to do, so I stopped. I'm meant to take these stupid hormones that I've refused to take them because I am chromosomically male. I'm not going to take dangerous cancer causing chemicals every day of my life. When I was taking the estrogen, I had bladder pain. I was 4 stone overweight. I was constantly lethargic. When I stopped taking those pills, I was absolutely right as rain. So if we look at a transition back to male, let's look at that, what that would actually look like. And I think it's important to talk about this on the show because people think that you walk into the NHS, you change your gender in the same way you change a pair of shoes.
Yeah.
It's not like that. Right, so they would have to give me a mastectomy, so there's an operation to remove the breasts, and then you're going to be looking at taking testosterone. Well, there we've got another chemical going into your body every single day, that, you know, long-term studies
mood,
around testosterone aren't too clever.
Mood altering.
If they hadn't removed my testes, I'd have had a source of testosterone to begin with. So yeah, it was a consideration. And when you look at how they reform the penis, essentially they take a lot of skin from your arm and they build a piece of meat between your legs where the chances are it's probably not going to be functional anyway. So to me, it felt like I've already been butchered as a person. Do I want to go back to the butcher for some more butchering? Nah, yeah, I'll just live my life and hope for the best.
Probably not. Yeah. And when you, of course, then have an insight then when you hear about, I had a bit of work performed on the studio. I'm in a studio, a home studio in Salford. And a couple of lads came over from Hull, experts in it, Sophie, and one of them has a daughter who wants to be male. She's identifying as male. And she's 15 now, going on 16. And he's very concerned about it. He's a nice man. He's an open-minded man. He's not in any way bigoted towards anybody. And he's like, well, you know, we're calling her by the name she's asked us to call her by, and we're kind of walking around it, you know, on eggshells a little bit, me and the wife. But we're worried that she wants to start taking drugs, hormones and whatnot. And then we're worried that she's going to want to have surgery. You've got a really unique, you've got certainly a much greater insight into this than anybody that I that you know that would come on this program regularly. So you'd see this as a really dangerous area, wouldn't you, I suppose?
That's the main reason I went public when I did, because it felt like I'd been toying with it for a long time, and it felt like the peak of this whole trans narrative. And I was just very worried about young children. And I thought if I could share the story with other people, that it doesn't, for me, part of the reason of not changing back as well, it's like, it doesn't matter how much you change the external part of your body, your brain and your heart are still the same, right? So if I don't work through the trauma of everything I've been through, you know, I can change the skin a million times. And I think that is what I'm worried about most. You've got these kids going into school, they're getting sold an agenda, they're getting supported to do, you know, to change gender. And I don't want to take anything away from anyone that feels like they've got gender dysphoria. But I believe that we've actually manufactured gender dysphoria. So when John Money was doing all these sort of psychological reviews on people and the nature versus nurture idea, he actually coined gender ideology. So prior to the 50s, there was just birth sex, and birth sex was, you know, based on your chromosome or your birth genitalia. Now, what John Money did is he created two boxes, two categories, male and female. And within each of those boxes, he created traits. So like a boy might like football and a girl might like dolls, on, you know, really primitive example. But if you then program that into society over the next 60, 70 years, the, you know, there's girls' things and boys' things. We see it through the TV, the magazines, the newspapers. Then you get to a point where you've got a perfectly normal female or a perfectly normal male who is into something that's not in their box. So a boy that likes dolls, for example. And rather than just think that's cool, everyone can like everything, no, you've got gender dysphoria because my traits don't fit into John Money's box.
Yeah.
So John Money created the problem of gender dysphoria, and then the medical profession have got a nice solution that makes millions of dollars every year in the US. I think they introduced the problem in order to later introduce the solution.
Do you know, I did, I was lucky enough to meet a transsexual woman on the show called Diane. Every time this comes up, I keep saying I'll get Diane back, and I never do, but I will eventually. Right. Now, Diane would be in her 60s, born male, transitioned to female years ago. Gender dysphoria, great person, very understanding of this issue, as you are, for different reasons. But Diane would consider herself to be an example of how the surgery is a success, because without it, and she couldn't have lived and couldn't have enjoyed and couldn't have had any sort of a fulfilling life. So that's an interesting one, that. And we had a very long conversation on this programme about that. She explained how it all worked, and has been living as female with female genitalia for years and years, and is very happy.
And I wouldn't want to take that away from anybody.
Oh, no, of course
and I've
not.
Got
yeah.
a couple of friends myself. They're exactly the same way, that are older and are trans. And I think what it comes down to is like being an appropriate age to be able to make that decision. So maybe when you're 18 onwards, let's say, you can do that. But what I worry about is the young children. And, you know, everyone in the mainstream will tell you that this isn't happening anymore. We're not pushing puberty blockers on people. And maybe we're not doing it in the NHS, but we are doing it in the private sector. There are gender clinics that have popped up that are run by ex-members of the Tavistock that are allowing access to puberty blockers to children at a young age. So to me, I honestly really don't mind what anybody does at an age they can make a decision. But you and I both know that that Christmas present that we got at age 12, we weren't playing with it when we were 15.
Right. You're right. And by the way, Diane wouldn't have had any puberty blockers or any of that nonsense. And yep. She would have made that very clear on the programme. She doesn't support that. She thinks it's insane.
I think it's insane as well.
She thinks it's insane, does Diane. Diane as well, she's living in living in Munster now, West Waterford, I believe. Sophie Ottaway is our guest. Cloacal extrophy, is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's it, you've got it right.
Cloacal extrophy, not too bad, am I? An amazing life Sophie has had, and has had to deal with some heavy, heavy duty stuff, right? Found out 15 years ago that, in fact, she was actually born a he, but with cloacal extrophy had organs born, so the organs were outside the body when he was born, and a split penis, and the doctors decided, God, I shouldn't say this, but I know others have said it, I know you've said it, you've used the term experimented on Sophie. That's what they did. And they turned the baby boy into a baby girl, but left Sophie with lasting, very serious health issues. She blew the whistle on this because it was terrible. In some ways, it's kind of morphed into a lot of what we're seeing happen to young kids today through Tavistock and through the NHS, this gender ideology stuff we talk about. So it's really, really good to have Sophie on the programme. We have esoteric listeners. Wait till you hear this. This is from Lisa. Richie, fantastic lady is Sophie. I'm thinking about how our body and soul can have an awareness that our conscious being doesn't always understand. My question is, did Sophie grow up feeling like a sort of disconnection with her body, for lack of better words? And when she found out that she was born male, did it feel like something, some strange feelings were finally explained, like a veil was lifted? That's a great question. Did you have some subconscious understanding of this as a teenager, as a seven-year-old, as an eight-year-old?
It's a fantastic question. I would say a lot of people ask me a very similar question, which was, oh, did you grow up feeling that you was, you know, in the wrong body or whatever? It's what I would like to get across first is we can only ever know what we've experienced, right? So I know what it feels like to be a Sophie in my body, but I don't know what it's like to be a Sophie in a real female body. So if they say, did you feel like a boy or did you feel like a girl? No one's ever actually felt what it's like to be on the other side, have they? It's a feeling that, how could you know a feeling you've never experienced? But to come to answer her question, I obviously knew something was badly wrong, and my parents explained to me that I had a lot of urological problems. So I knew that I was bladder incontinent. I knew that my genitalia didn't look quite right, and I knew that there was nothing internal. So I knew there was going to be some problems in my life, but I did not know that I was male and they'd done all of this stuff to me. So yeah, to talk about a disconnect, I would say I didn't love my body. I didn't love myself. I focused a lot on, even as a kid, I was always someone that just kept busy, kept the mind busy. And I really didn't care what my body looked like. I do a lot more now. It's not that I've been obsessed about my appearance. It's just I take a lot more interest in health and well-being. But yeah, there was a massive disconnect. I think I just, growing up, I just didn't care, really, to be honest.
Didn't care, yeah. Can I ask you about relation? By the way, sophiesstory.com, folks, is a website. You'll find Sophie on Twitter. Do follow her there, NorthernOtter86, at NorthernOtter86. And it's sophiesstory.com to find out more about this. Look, you won't be surprised. Some lovely messages coming in from people saying your outlook is wonderful. It's great to have you on. It's cheering people up. Frank says, Sophie even is superb, Richie. Great that she's outing this shit. That's from Frank.
Love him.
It's lovely, yeah. Are you happy now? Tell us about relationships. Was getting into romantic relationships, was that a difficulty for you?
Well, it's not been easy. Because growing up, obviously, I didn't know that I was born male. So I went through school, attracted to females, but in the 80s and 90s, you know, that was not really the done thing. So no. I felt I was a closeted lesbian most of my school life. And then I attempted relationships with a couple of men, and nice boys, to be honest. But as you can understand, it's not easy for a male to, have a relationship with a female. But I guess looking back, I didn't know then, but it would be a male to have a relationship with a male. But, you know, without a vagina, that's not a relationship that's going to be easy to maintain.
No.
Obviously, when I found out about my gender, things changed, and I've date women, have dated women for a long time now, and that's been it's a lot easier, it's more natural for me. That's I know I'm attracted to women. I honestly think I'm a straight man that they've just chucked into this vessel, but yeah, it's been difficult, especially, you know, given the incontinence issues, given the fact that, you know, there's a lot of health problems. Yeah, it's been hard, but I've been really blessed to meet some really nice people along the way. I'm not in a relationship currently, but up until about, I don't know, a year ago I was, but sadly, when I went public with my story, decided to go public with my story, that the person, the girl that I was with, it was just a little bit too much for her, I think, quite a quiet person, and just didn't want to really be on that public journey. So that was the end of that, really. So another illustration about how my background is
damaging. Yeah. And did you understand that with the lady in question saying, look, Sophie, I can't be part of this. It must have been difficult for you to hear that, but did you understand it?
Do you know what? I absolutely understand it. I get it. I really do. But if I look back through the media journey that I was doing in the summer last year, I spent, everyone's like, how are you getting on? And I was actually like, the pain I was feeling was much heavier about the breakup and not being with her than it was around, oh my God, I've just gone on telly telling everybody that I weigh myself and I've had my dick lobbed off. Do you know what I mean? It was like, but that almost helped me in a way because like, I was so worried about the breakup that I just didn't care.
I love what you said there. Yeah, how did you spend your summer last summer, Sophie? Well, I went on telly. I told everybody I couldn't wee, or what did you say? Lopped my dick off.
I wee myself. And I wee myself, and they lopped my dick off. Yeah. I didn't actually say that, but that's a summary.
No, but that was the gist of it. So tell us this then, with regards to having, I don't want to say restitution. I don't know what it is. I mean, you're going to tell us what it is you're looking for, really. Where are you in your battle? Again, that's a very confrontational way of putting it. But your quest, I suppose, to get answers from the state and from the NHS, where is that right now, today?
So it was a massive standstill for a long time because the NHS didn't want to give me any answers and the solicitors didn't want to have anything to do with it because on medical negligence claims, you've got a 3-year window between the event of, you know, whatever the date of knowledge is. And a lot of the solicitors wanted to class my date of knowledge as being at 22 when I found out the computer screen. But luckily, since the media journey, I've not secured it yet, but I'm in talks with a couple of solicitors where they're willing to look at the date of knowledge of when I went into hospital with sepsis, and it was the first time that I knew that there'd been a rotting pseudo vagina in my abdomen. So hopefully we can pursue something legally there. I cross my fingers. In terms of what, it's not about money for me. I mean, don't get me wrong, money is nice, but what I really want is to change legislation. I want to make sure that this can never happen to another baby again. And if I can achieve that, then that's my life done. It was well worth everything that I went through.
And let's hope you do, because, yeah, the possibility is it can and could and maybe is happening again. From Emma, from Tony, from Aaron, from Anthony, beautiful messages all saying, loving to hear you. One from Seamus, very good question is from Seamus. Tremendous for Sophie to bring this to light. Did you ever need counselling or therapy at all after, particularly after, You had to come to terms? Because I know you said you had your issues with drink, and you're very frank about that, very honest. So did you go down the therapy, the talk therapy route? Was that any good, or how did that
well,
work?
What I like to say is, you know, if you're going to do something as big as what they did to me at birth, you'd think that if that was a thing to do, you'd build in some support for if the patient was ever to find out. Well, the GP surgery, which is the old fire station in Beverley of East Yorkshire, they couldn't give less of a toss when I found out, to be honest. I was offered nothing. I got nothing. And I've paid for counselling a few sessions over the years, but most of the work I've done has kind of been just sitting with myself. I do have to give them some credit. When I got poorly with the sepsis, they did arrange for 6 sessions of NHS counselling. But for anyone that's interacted with the mental health regime within the UK, you get sort of 6 sessions. And then when you've had that sort of spring of sessions, you have to go back through the referral process again to, as a new case, to get, and you won't get the same counsellor. So basically, in my opinion, interacting with NHS mental health services is just utterly pointless and fruitless. I hope it works for some people, but for me, the one time I did get it, the woman was amazing, by the way. Like, if she's listening, she was an amazing counsellor. But I mean, the process that surrounds it, you know, you build a relationship with someone to be able to talk about very personal things and start to overcome things, and then your counsellor's pulled from under you and you've got to reapply. But yeah, I think a lot of this is about coming to terms with who you are. And I think that's a journey that I'm not entirely sure that a counsellor is a great thing, but I know that's controversial.
No, it's not controversial at all. There are a number of studies emerging. Studies are emerging all the time, but are saying that talk therapy isn't always, isn't good for everybody, because a lot of time talk therapy can be narcissistic in some ways, where the person who needs the therapy spends a lot of time talking about the problems over and over and over again and isn't looking very hard at the solutions. Yeah. In fact, I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast recently. He had a lovely guest on, an amazing woman, and she's been writing books about psychotherapy. And she says, look, talk therapy is not always great. You know, it can make things worse. It can make people feel even worse and even more hurt and low over a period of time. But look, I can say for me, because I had a very traumatic childhood, I never had to go through what you went through. But I had a difficult time. It was very useful for me in my teens. And it wasn't trauma focused. So I wasn't sitting there all the time crying about or whinging about the bad things that were done to me. I was kind of focusing on how I couldn't have done anything about it and how I would kind of move on from it. And the thing about you, the terrible thing that happened to you, of course, you know this, you don't need to be told this, you couldn't have done anything about it. That's the worst of it. But it's also the best of it, isn't it? Knowing that this was out of your hands, what happened to you, you couldn't have done anything about it. But you're doing something about it now. Do me a favour, will you? I do mean this when I say it. When there's any news at all, don't hesitate to let us know and come back on.
Thank you so much, Yao. That would be my pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Richie. It's been so nice to meet you and to talk to you. To your audience.
No, it's been my pleasure. And you know, even not so much about your own case and your own story, I know you've got plenty to say about the madness of the gender politics. So when you feel like a rant, give us a shout and we'll facilitate it, because I like listening to a good rant as much as I like a good kind of rant myself. But just before you get the very final word, you'll find Sophie on Twitter, as I've already said. It's at NorthernOtter86, and sophiesstory.com is the website. There's a nice collection there of interviews that Sophie has done with other eminent broadcasters and researchers. So final word to you, and thanks so much for your time. I've really enjoyed meeting you.
Oh no, thank you so much, and thanks to everyone listening. And if anybody needs anything, or if anybody out there knows somebody with my condition or has been through a similar journey, there's an inbox on sophiesstory.com. I would love to hear from anybody else that might have suffered the same trauma.
Have a fantastic weekend, Sophie. Don't be a stranger. Thanks again.
Thanks, Richie. Take care.
And you too. Bye for now. Sophie Ottaway, live on Thursday's Richie Allen Show. I had to double check. It's Thursday. Yeah, I'm all over the place here. Lots and lots of commentary and messages on this. Thank you. Emma says, hi Emma. Brilliant guest, Sophie is. Thank you. Anthony said, an amazingly courageous person. I don't know if I could do the same or be as courageous or as optimistic as she is. I don't either, to be honest. I mean, I know the medical issues that she deals with are debilitating. And when I think about them, I don't know if I could be as philosophical about things, but maybe we could be. Maybe when faced with these challenges, we've all got some of that in us, that ability to kind of just keep putting one foot in front of the other. Kay says, interesting this, Richie, you're right, people never questioned doctors. They were listened to as if they were God, which is why the elderly queued up for the COVID jabs. They just could not envisage the medical profession would lie to them. That's an excellent point, Kay, when you think back to early 2021 when they began to roll the jabs out to people. It's an excellent point. Now I'm pretty much done for the Richie Allen Show this week, only this week. The podcast, the papers thing, will be online tomorrow. Here's one for you. I was going to take Sunday off and not do the melodies. Calm down, I said, only because I've been struggling with my voice all week. I thought I'd give it a rest. However, it's Mothering Sunday, isn't it? And I've already taken about a dozen requests for Sunday morning melodies for Mother's Day. So I'm going to do it. I'll whisper on Sunday morning, but I will be on air Sunday at 10 o'clock UK time with Sunday morning melodies. In the meantime, thank you so much to my two guests today, to Sophie Ottaway, you just heard Sophie, and to Melissa Shumay. Thank you for listening this week, and thanks so much for supporting The Richie Allen Show. I'm closing out with this from Nancy Wilson and Heart, a song called These Dreams. Until next time, from your BBG, Sloan Tommel, have a fantastic weekend. Bye now.